It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Monday was the filing deadline for Wisconsin candidates to get on the ballot for the upcoming partisan primary election on August 11th.
The final field of candidates for the Democratic pick for governor is sprawling, and Republicans have already gotten behind U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany.
With this backdrop, Wisconsin is expecting a visit from President Donald Trump in Chippewa County on Friday. It's the first visit of his second term.
Wisconsin political journalist Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's a fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School and political columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
It's nice to be with you.
All right, we've got a crowded field of Democrats for governor. Eight had filed papers. One, Kirk Bangstad, it looks like he didn't have enough signatures on it, so seven as of now. Republicans, on the other hand, have gotten behind Tom Tiffany, current U.S. representative. What do you think of that dynamic? Lots of Democrats in their primary, pretty much unified on the Republican side.
Yeah, so, sometimes the number of candidates that get into a primary campaign tells you something about the political cycle. And in this case, I think it tells you that Democrats see the conditions as being good for their party, driven by President Trump's low and declining ratings. And by the same token, you didn't have a lot of action on the Republican side. You had one candidate, Tom Tiffany, sort of clearing the field. It's, on the one hand, it's good for Tom Tiffany to be the only, to be unopposed in the Republican primary, but it's also a reflection of the fact that his party faces a lot of headwinds this year. And the reverse is true. The Democrats are looking at a good cycle, but they're also looking at the uncertainty of a multi-candidate primary. And, some Democrats are nervous about, whether they're going to nominate the best candidate or not.
Right. And an argument on primaries sometimes is, oh, no, it's bad. We've got lots of candidates. They're going to beat up on each other. We're wasting a lot of money here. The pro side is, the candidates are getting experience in a tough campaign. They're going to be ready to rock, and they know who their attack ads are going against for the fall election. How do you weigh those two things?
Yeah, so it just, we've got plenty of examples in Wisconsin's own history of both. I mean, we have cases where, a lesser known candidate has been catapulted into the general election by pulling off, a striking primary victory. I mean, Russ Feingold in 1992 is easily the best example of that. And we've had other, examples in both parties, whether it's for senator, for governor, of divisive races where the party, never quite recovered and went into the general election kind of limping.
On the Democratic side of the field, you wrote pretty recently, actually, Craig, about the changing Democratic primary electorate. What have you seen over the years, and how does it influence that race?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how voters identify themselves, kind of on the left-right spectrum, conservative, very conservative, liberal, very liberal, or moderate, Democratic voters, going back over 15 years of polling we have from Marquette, are increasingly liberal by their own definition. There are very few, if any, conservative Democrats left in the primary electorate. And, a somewhat declining percentage of moderates. The majority of Democratic voters are now identified as liberal. And the percentage that identify as very liberal has gone up, has kind of doubled in the last decade or so, from about 12 or 13% of Democratic voters in Wisconsin to more than 25%. So that tells you that I think there's more opportunity than there would have been in the past for a candidate on the left side of the Democratic spectrum. I think the environment's a little bit more challenging than in the past for, moderate Democratic candidates, but it's still a big pool of voters. Wisconsin has an open primary, so there are going to be plenty of independents and plenty of voters, in the center to right wing of the party will also be voting in August.
The dynamic you were just talking about is a hopeful thing, I think, for progressives or people on the left of the Democratic Party, a fearful thing for people maybe in the establishment. It might be that primary dynamic steers the nomination to a more left-leaning candidate that at least some might fear that might be a liability then in a general election. What do you see in that probably back and forth within the party?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this primary, I mean, not a lot in some respects has happened in this primary.
Right.
I mean, the candidates really haven't, the air wars really haven't begun in earnest. Candidates came in with different levels of name ID. You've got a candidate in Mandela Barnes who's been on a statewide ballot, almost won a race for U.S. Senate. He's been easily the best known Democrat in the race. You got a bunch of candidates with low name ID. And then you've got Francesca Hong, the state legislator from Madison, who's been able to kind of generate buzz and attention. She's a Democratic socialist, so she is kind of benefiting from this growing number of very liberal voters in the Democratic electorate. And in some cases, these voters have been, you know, mobilized and motivated by their outrage over the Trump presidency. So that kind of gives her an opening. But at the same time, as you noted, you know, there are Democrats in the party who are nervous. There are Democrats in the party who think that they'd have a hard time winning with Francesca Hong as their candidate. And, you know, there are electability questions about other candidates as well. Electability is always kind of lurking there in these races. It's always kind of suspenseful and mysterious to think about is the average Democratic primary voter thinking about just winning in November, or are they voting with their heart?
On the Republican side, a Tom Tiffany sitting U.S. representative. He does have a challenger there, Andy Manske, a medical services technician, never held office before. The Republican Party wants Tom Tiffany, it looks like. President Trump has backed him. He's been a very Trump-leaning candidate over the years. Electability-wise, what do you think that means for the most likely Republican candidate here?
Well, again, I think it's in some respects a good thing for him to have the party behind him, unified behind him, and not have to spend a lot of money against other Republicans in the primary. At the same time, he's not exactly the candidate you draw up on paper to win in a purple state in what looks like a really challenging cycle for Republicans. I mean, he's from northern Wisconsin, which we haven't seen a lot of winning statewide candidates come from that part of the state. He's really conservative. You know, he's taken some votes that are going to get a lot of attention in this election, including the one against certifying the presidential results in two states. To the extent that Donald Trump is a potential drag on Republican candidates in competitive states in November, you know, Tom Tiffany, I think, will have a hard time separating himself from Donald Trump. But, you know, if he runs a smart and effective campaign, depending on what Democratic opponent he draws, you know, we could have a real contest on our hands.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert, longtime political columnist and researcher. We have nomination papers or election papers filed this week, looking ahead to the primary. Now, Craig, President Trump visiting Wisconsin later this week, Chippewa County. Why now? Why there, do you think?
Well, you know, Western Wisconsin is a traditional battleground within a battleground. You've got the third congressional race, which is the one seat, the one House seat of Wisconsin's eight U.S. House seats that's really been in play in recent years. It's a top target for Democrats nationally. You've also got a primary for the 7th congressional district on the Republican side, which is Tom Tiffany's current seat, which he's vacating to run for governor. And so, you know, the Trump visit kind of plays in both those races. You know, these visits by presidents are always kind of potentially double-edged, right? Because especially when they have negative job ratings like Donald Trump has. I mean, it's not great. You know, it's not a great look in a general election sense, but it also, you know, can always have the potential to kind of, you know, push up turnout, at least when the visit occurs closer to an election, drive up turnout on your side and motivate your base.
A big topic of Trump's visit, as advertised so far, is support for farmers, something called rural opportunity zones. We've seen concern from farmers about the impact of tariffs and trade wars, about cuts in rural health care. Trump administration saying they're going to backfill some of those cuts to health care. Voting-wise, rural voters, Craig, have swung Republican in recent years. Is there any reason to think that could change?
Well, we do have, you know, this situation of voters, of farmers hurting and rural areas hurting. We have the impact of tariffs. So, you know, that's a potential kind of crack, fault line in the rural base for Republicans. In the past, you know, when tariffs, you know, were used as a policy in the first Trump administration. And even though they sort of complicated the lives of farmers, that did not shake their support for Donald Trump. But there's sort of two different questions, I think, about, you know, the Republican Party's rural base. And that, and one is, you know, how they feel about Donald Trump and whether they'll stick with the Republican Party. And the other is whether they'll vote and turnout. And midterm elections are, you know, heavily about turnout, about which side is more motivated and more mobilized. And so, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of signs in these intervening off-year elections that Democratic voters are hyper-mobilized. The questions I think about turnout are on the other side.
State legislature also up for grabs now in a way that maybe it hadn't been until the change in maps, a more friendly map for Democrats, or at least less unfriendly map for Democrats now. Do you see either chamber at play in this election?
Absolutely. I think we see both chambers at play. I think the conventional wisdom, you know, among political insiders is that, you know, the assembly, it's a little bit of a heavier lift for Democrats to take the assembly than it is to take the state Senate, but both chambers are certainly in play. I mean, you know, Robin Voss, the longtime leader of the state assembly, who's been very effective politically in maintaining these Republican majorities. Now, for a long time, they were under a very favorable map. That map is less favorable now, but he's kind of on his way out the door. So one question is, you know, whether he'll be, you know, as forceful a driver of assembly elections in this state as he has been in past cycles. But both chambers are absolutely in play. The governor's race is in play. Again, you know, huge opportunities for Democrats here because it's been a long time since they were able to win unified control of state government. And this is certainly an opportunity to do that.
Craig, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It's been great.
That's Craig Gilbert from the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School, also a political columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Been talking about the latest on election season in Wisconsin ahead of President Trump's visit to Chippewa County later this week. Wisconsin's partisan primary election takes place on August 11th.
Coming up, some Wisconsin communities stop using AI-powered law enforcement cameras. Hear from a researcher on privacy issues as footage keeps building up.
There's hundreds, thousands of different communities and different cameras across the country combined with these other data sources, and each community is feeding into that.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some Wisconsin communities have recently decided to stop using AI-powered law enforcement cameras.
Dane County, Sturgeon Bay, Oshkosh, and Fitchburg are among the latest local governments to cut ties with Flock, a private surveillance company.
Flock cameras can read license plates and register car color, make and model, stickers, and other identifying features. That info is uploaded to a database that can be accessed by law enforcement and federal agencies nationwide.
Last year, at least 221 Wisconsin law enforcement agencies used Flock cameras, according to the Wisconsin Examiner.
Isaiah Holmes is a journalist with the Wisconsin Examiner. Isaiah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've seen a weird reversal. It seems like Flock was going into more and more communities for a long time. Now we're starting to see Wisconsin communities stop their contracts with Flock. What do you see driving those decisions to reverse course in those communities?
Yeah, so one thing that is going on a lot is there is a lot of pushback from individual community members and organizing groups. Say in Milwaukee, you know, you have the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, you have the Milwaukee Turners, the ACLU, Milwaukee for Palestine. All these different groups have kind of focused on not just Flock, but also the facial recognition concerns, which are different technologies. But oftentimes people come to those meetings, usually to the Fire and Police Commission, and they'll express a lot of different concerns about those things. And also the Milwaukee County board meetings to try to get communication about the Milwaukee sheriff. And then in other communities around the state, you know, what's interesting is that this isn't something like a big campaign or something, or something where it's like a unified movement or something. It's a lot of individual community members, oftentimes unaffiliated with different organizations, who are coming out. And when they learn about Flock, they're just very uncomfortable with it. And then that trickles up into the elected bodies, common councils, and this sort of thing.
As you have been following this, and you've been following this for a good long time now, Isaiah, what are some of the most common concerns that you hear people bringing up at these police and fire meetings or county board meetings or what have you?
Mm-hmm. There's a couple different layers to it. For one, some people are very uncomfortable with the idea of someone actively feeling as though they're being actively watched and monitored in a perpetual or kind of passive way that's kind of always going on. You know, it's one thing to kind of walk into a convenience store or something and know that, you know, there's a security camera there. It's another thing to be able to be driving on an open road from one end of the state to the other, or just in your community, and feeling like if someone wanted to, they could just track and just kind of recreate your journey, you know? So some of it involves that. Some of it involves concerns with the federal government and the current president right now, particularly when it comes to the use of the federal government, whether it's immigration enforcement or Homeland Security or the FBI, to kind of go after a particular marginalized groups or even specific communities who may be perceived as enemies of the MAGA movement, basically, or of President Trump. There's also concerns now that are kind of valid now of individual officers or units of officers using these technologies in kind of abusive ways. So on an individual level, using it to track loved ones, girlfriends, that sort of thing, or using it to monitor protests. So it kind of spans the gamut, really.
And what have law enforcement agencies who are using these Flock cameras said in their defense when they're challenged at meetings like this?
Oftentimes, the law enforcement agencies are very quick to tout the successes that they've had or that they feel that they've had of solving different crimes. They often put the violent crimes at the forefront. So whether it's violent crime, homicide, solving homicide cases, or at least developing suspects or using it to make arrests, or tracking stolen vehicles, any number of those types of things. And it can kind of shift or vary depending on kind of what the public safety concerns or priorities of that community may be. You know, some communities deal with gun violence more. Some communities deal with specific cars or reckless driving or whatnot. So they're very quick to kind of point out and say this technology has been very helpful in kind of developing those cases and layer it on top of other technologies. Like there was a recent arrest that was made involving in Wauwatosa, where Flock and drones were used together. And prior to the cases of officers kind of being formally charged with misusing Flock, some police chiefs, like the Milwaukee police chief, would kind of say, well, these things could theoretically be abused, but no one has, or, you know, that sort of thing. And they can't really say that anymore. So you do get a tone from some law enforcement agencies, like I just talked to the Green Bay police chief late last week, who are a bit more reflective about Flock, and they see it as a very useful tool while also understanding the privacy concerns of people, seeing those concerns as legitimate and not fanciful in any way, and trying to find, in their view, a balance to that.
Now, in Oshkosh, the Common Council rescinded their contract with Flock less than 24 hours after approving a one-year renewal. And they said in changing that vote that Flock had effectively misled them about what the cameras and the data collection systems were capable of. Is this something you've run into elsewhere? What do we know about the level of transparency from Flock and their communication with local law enforcement and local governments making these decisions?
One thing, and this happened in Verona as well, when they decided to kind of sever ties with Flock, there's an attitude amongst some of these elected bodies that while they may trust their police departments, they don't trust the company anymore and they don't trust the product. So with Oshkosh, what you had was a situation where the council was initially supportive of it, despite the various controversies that were going on. At this point, a couple of officers had been charged, and then they found out later that the company or a company representative had essentially misled them or kind of given them not accurate information about Flock's capabilities to kind of visualize someone's movements as a kind of heat map, you know, which gets at another question too of there is some disagreement when you talk to different law enforcement organizations about whether or not this is tracking. A lot of people feel like this is a form of tracking, perpetual tracking. I think a lot of elected bodies are kind of finding themselves wondering what are these technologies fully capable of doing, and also just not trusting the company anymore, even if they still trust their police department.
Isaiah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Isaiah Holmes, a journalist with the Wisconsin Examiner who's been following community pushback against Flock cameras here in Wisconsin. Now for a closer look at these AI-powered law enforcement cameras and their impacts on public safety and privacy, we're joined by Alan Rubel, professor and former director of the Information School at UW-Madison. Alan, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now we've had various kind of cameras, right, on our streets for years. These Flock cameras are a little different. They're networked. They compile all this data. How do you see this being qualitatively different, a part of just maybe more of these cameras?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things that are particularly important. One is that, as you mentioned, they are networked and they are also digital, right? So the data from these cameras is not the traditional CCTV, which may be held on local storage devices. They're digitized. Those images collected from Flock cameras can be put into databases and combined with data from other sources, cameras from other companies, cameras that are owned and deployed by government actors. Moreover, they're taking place alongside several other important technological developments, including facial recognition technology, which has really concerned a lot of people, social media monitoring, and the ability to combine all of these different data sources using machine learning techniques that allow for very substantial inferences to happen using all of this different data. So, yeah, cameras have been with us for a long, long time, but we're seeing lots of different surveillance technologies and practices combining with computational power that leads to something I think that is quite new.
And this is held in a lot of hands in some ways. There's the private company that's running this. There's my local municipal, say, police department or county sheriff's office, which may be communicating with other police departments, any of which may be communicating with federal authorities. This could be shared in a lot of ways that aren't immediately obvious, right?
Yeah, I think that's actually another really important component to this that adds to that milieu. You know, any individual community, it might make sense for them to agree to have Flock cameras or another company's cameras around the streets because they're thinking about crime in their community. But there's a kind of a collective action problem. There's, you know, hundreds, thousands of different communities and different cameras across the country combined with these other data sources, and each community is feeding into that. So there's this massive hole where this large database creates something new. So yes, it's held by lots of different actors and potentially accessed by anybody across that network.
And I hear in the protest we were just talking about, talking to Isaiah about a couple concerns about misuse. One is that individual, that police officer who allegedly in Milwaukee, for example, is using this to track not somebody involved with a crime, but somebody he's having a romantic dispute with. It seems like that's something that you could maybe have policies to make that less of a worry. How big a concern is that individual abuse for you?
It is a very big concern. And yes, there is always the possibility of having policy responses to those kinds of abuses. But for one, it's not obvious that all of the abuses are easily caught. The abuses happen and most policy responses are reactive, right? Mm. So harm is already done. And we know just any kind of technology that is used for control or surveillance or information collection is open for abuse. And we have to build that into the calculation as to whether these kind of technologies are justifiable at all.
Now, those are individual abuses. There's a wider, I think, more fundamental concern with how much do I want my government surveilling me? And that's what's coming up at a lot of these meetings we're hearing.
Yeah, and I really I listened to the discussion with Isaiah, and I think that that really brought up several important points. I want to distinguish between a couple of types of concerns in that category that you just raised. One is, yeah, government actors, law enforcement, or other government agencies, it's not just law enforcement, it could be any government actor, using the power of the surveillance for unjustifiable reasons, right? That is important. But there's this other issue, like that people might be concerned about that from the standpoint of their own privacy, which is the way you sort of articulated it. But there's this other concern that I think is a little more abstract, but I think it's more important and a little bit hard to articulate. And that is that as these surveillance technologies and practices become more powerful, they allow for governments to act in fairly arbitrary ways. That may not affect you, it may not affect me, but it's going to affect somebody. It's very easy to conduct surveillance on any kind of behavior. There are very few Fourth Amendment protections, which we might get into, and there's just a lot of discretion. So using these surveillance technologies, as Isaiah mentioned earlier, on just straight up political activities, using them on, you know, relatively low stakes, do scare quotes offenses like minor immigration violations, right? That allows for a kind of arbitrary set of deployments of state power. And that's slightly different from the privacy issue.
Well, and the fact that this is through a private company, it seems like there's workarounds in some ways, things that you used to say, hey, we're going to need a warrant. We're going to need to go to a judge, an administrative judge in some cases, and get a warrant to do these things. Now you can do a lot of these things without a warrant.
Yeah, there's essentially no legal limitations on private organizations collecting information, consolidating information, analyzing information, developing products to sell to the government that do all these things, and to have them be used for law enforcement purposes. So there's a longstanding legal doctrine, and I don't want to go too deep into Fourth Amendment law here, but this longstanding legal doctrine that starts with the Fourth Amendment that says that the government has to have probable cause to get a warrant, that people should be free from unreasonable, the person should be, person's houses, papers, and effects should be protected from unreasonable searches and seizures. And then in the late 60s and early 70s, this doctrine developed called the third party doctrine, which said that private actors, third parties, their data is not subject to the Fourth Amendment. That is, police can go to banks or phone companies or Flock and get data without a warrant. So that just opens up this possibility that facial recognition technology companies, Flock cameras, and others can do this kind of surveillance work and then sell their products to governments to conduct surveillance.
Now, late last year, we talked with Detective Daniel Coons of the Beaver Dam Police Department, who said the Flock cameras are increasingly vital for their public safety work. Here's a listen to someone he had to say.
But it's no different, essentially, than having 11 officers, at least at our agency, having 11 officers on these street corners running license plates. We obviously don't have the resource to do that, nor would we. But this allows us to capture those license plates, which are in public, and there's no expectation of privacy out in public when you're driving around your vehicle. Your license plate by law is required to be legible and visible to law enforcement or anybody.
Right. So these Flock cameras aren't in my bedroom. They're out on a public street where I have to publicly display this information. Maybe not such a concern?
No, I disagree for a couple of reasons. That's an important clip, and I think this is a really important perspective. And I have a couple of things that I want to add. One is that any surveillance technology is going to be useful for the law enforcement project, right? Wiretapping. The ability to actually, say, run imaging devices across walls, thermal imaging devices, whatever it happens to be, that will make a law enforcement job easier. But we do, in fact, have a Fourth Amendment, right? The job of the Fourth Amendment is to protect us against abuses. That's not to say that what the officer in Beaver Dam is saying is itself an abuse. No, but that's not good enough. That just the mere fact that it makes it easier or is a tool that is useful is not enough. Second, I think that, yes, while it's true that you don't have an expectation of privacy in one's license plate, there is a difference in, say, a random collection of a license plate versus pointed surveillance of certain people's license plates, right? It may not be a violation of my privacy to have my license plate read by a reader. However, it can be an abuse of power to train those license plate readers on political activities or on people you just don't like, right? So I think, you know, there's different ways that surveillance can be surveillance can happen, and it can be relatively innocuous and not impinge upon people's privacy, or it can be pointed and arbitrary. And that pointed and arbitrary is, I think, what's really at root the Fourth Amendment is about and what privacy protection should be about.
As we wrap up briefly, we're having these arguments one city at a time, one county at a time. Do you want to see states or even the federal government set some baselines or say, hey, here's where the Fourth Amendment should be balanced, and here's how we should and shouldn't use Flock?
No, absolutely. You know, I think the Fourth Amendment is, you know, a constitutional creature, and judges and courts will interpret it. I would like to see a greater emphasis on, you know, predication requirements, like what kinds of rationales we ought to have in place to protect against arbitrary uses and excessive surveillance, whether that's legislation, whether it is, you know, memorandums of understanding across states or municipalities about what data can be used, how it can be used, how it can be stored, that kind of thing. Yes, I think that there is a very important broader collective action issue here that really should be addressed more broadly.
Alan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Rubel is a professor at the Information School at UW-Madison. We also heard from journalist Isaiah Holmes with the Wisconsin Examiner. In a statement to WPR, the Flock company said, quote, "At Oshkosh, there was confusion about a map view in our license plate reader product that shows where a vehicle is detected by fixed cameras during Flock's 30-day retention period. It does not identify a driver, track a person, or create a pattern of life." And regarding Milwaukee, misuse of any law enforcement tool is unacceptable. This case is exactly why Flock builds our technology to include immutable, transparent audit trails so rare cases of potential abuse can be detected, investigated, and addressed.
Coming up, a new documentary from the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project honors 8 Milwaukee elders with remarkable life lessons.
Too often, we only celebrate people after they're gone. And by the time people are gone, they take all of their lessons, all of their advice with them.
A preview of the documentary Beacons of Brew City, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about self-love.
Feeling like you're different from your peers can have a big impact on your self-acceptance. But as Miriam Brabham of Green Bay tells us, a nurturing community helped her learn how to love her hair. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
When I was young, I hated my hair. It spent most of its time tightly pulled into lopsided buns, surrounded by a halo of curly flyaways. In those early years, my curls were traumatized. They were dehydrated and unappreciated, and they were a visual reminder of what I didn't know and how I didn't fit in. As a multi-ethnic Black girl who was also a Messianic Jew, 9-year-old me saw my curls as yet another thing that othered me. At a North Chicago YMCA, I would watch the other girls after swim class with envy. Passing small combs through their wet, straight hair, they would sigh and huff as they started from the top of their heads and found resistance at the ends. These girls would finish detangling their whole head in 5 minutes. After swim class, I didn't have time to wash my thick hair. While the smell of Pantene and Suave filled the air, I used the water to help me gather my curls into an outstretched scrunchie. These rebellious curls, stinking of chlorine and a lack of information, would begin to clump together into impossible knots, almost as if they were so suffocated by the world that they coiled together for comfort. I hated my hair. It was time, effort, and a major contributor to my imposter syndrome collection. Not white enough, not black enough, not Jewish enough, and yet too much. As I got older, the war with my hair became bitter. Temporary dyes, perms, and massive amounts of heat were met with split ends, chemical burns, and tension alopecia. Big chop after big chop left me at a shady hair braiding salon under the tracks on the north side of Chicago, where a woman used nail glue instead of hair glue and some overpriced box braids. Cutting out multiple braids, explaining why you shouldn't say good hair, and having monoracial people laugh at my ignorance left trauma residue all over my coils. The age of peace began when I started talking nice to my hair, instead of verbally berating it and subsequently myself. I learned so much about my hair while studying abroad in Botswana, Africa. The people were not shy or reserved in their comments and suggestions. They also didn't see me as separate from themselves. I just didn't know how to do my hair. The Botswana people taught me to love myself and my hair. I began to see my curls as an intrinsic part of myself. These curls can be playful springs that bounce in a sweet summer breeze. They can be strong, wide coils that keep the moisture to themselves and observe the world from scarves that set them on high. These curls can refuse to be tamed. They can go their own way, laughing at edge control and headbands alike. They can lay gently around my face. These curls define themselves and can easily change depending on the day and humidity. They have personality, and not shockingly, it's very similar to my own. So yes, there is trauma wrapped up in these curls. But like trauma in any of us, I am healing with love, time, and hair oil.
Miriam Brabham is a multicultural student success manager at UW Green Bay. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Pride Month is underway, and a new documentary aims to tell the stories of LGBTQ elders in the Milwaukee area whose lifetime of experiences and contributions are a lesson for all generations.
Beacons of Brew City is set to debut June 16th at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee. The documentary will feature interviews with one of the oldest living out gay men in Milwaukee and legends of the local drag scene, among others.
One of the subjects of the documentary is here. Karen Valentine, also known as KV, is a longtime Milwaukee-based drag performer, social columnist, and philanthropist. KV, welcome to the show.
My pleasure and honor to be sharing this wonderful beginning of Pride Month with you.
Yes, and Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project President Michael Takosh is here, who is behind the project celebrating some of the trailblazers in the local LGBTQ community. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You have worked, Michael, to document the history of the LGBT community in Milwaukee, throughout the state. This newest effort focusing on documenting eight elders in the Milwaukee area that are still alive, why is this important to you?
Well, it's really important, not just to me, but to the entire community, because for so long, LGBTQ history was only known through stories of shame and sorrow. So we only knew about some of our elders because they were arrested, because their names were printed in the paper, because they were, you know, publicly outed. You know, they were not stories of pride. They were not stories of hope, and they weren't encouraging or inspiring stories. And with that being said, it created a culture where a lot of people just simply did not talk about their past. The past was a source of embarrassment. And for many of our elders, it was also a source of trauma. So there wasn't the intergenerational transfer of knowledge, of history, of heritage that happens in almost every other community. A lot of LGBTQ people grow up completely disconnected from what came before. They have no idea they even have a history. For them, history begins when they join the community, when they come out, when they first, you know, go to their first queer space or gay bar or what have you. But even our project founder said when he came out in 1971, no one wanted to talk about the past. Hmm. It was simply forbidden. It was taboo because it was not a source of happiness. So the History Project is trying to overcome that systemic barrier to kind of dissolve that obstacle so that we can learn from our elders while we still have them. Too often, we only celebrate people after they're gone. And by the time people are gone, they take all of their lessons, all of their stories, all of their advice with them. So as somebody who grew up in a multi-generational family and saw the value and impact my elders made, I'd like to extend that same experience to our wider community.
KV, you bring a wealth of lessons and stories in your experience. You've been a fixture in Milwaukee's drag scene for decades. What does it mean to you to be featured in a project like this?
Well, I'm beyond flattered. It's so funny because, to be honest with you, Kate, I was busy just doing my thing. And finally, somebody brought it up to my attention that I'd been doing it for over 40 years. And when we did it, we were doing it more out of respect and raising money and awareness. Drag, when I did it, started doing it in the mid-80s, we were doing it to raise money for HIV and AIDS causes. And we were doing it for baseball teams and for volleyball teams and for choruses and whatever. And from there, you know, it went on. It really wasn't a career or a way to really make a living. We all had jobs during the day, and we were just flattered that people were happy to see us on the stage. And I never for once took for granted the honor that I was awarded by being able to take to the stage and be applauded to do my little fantasy of what I did when I was a child in my playroom by playing albums and lip syncing and, you know, frolicking around the room pretending I was in Las Vegas or some showroom.
You have said, KV, that just because you do put on a wig and eyelashes doesn't make you a drag queen. You have to earn it. I'm wondering, can you explain how?
With KV, I look at KV as a character, not unlike something that Carol Burnett or Bette Midler or even Joan Rivers, for instance, bring together, or Paul Rubens when he did Pee Wee Herman. They're a persona. They're somebody we create in a dressing room and we bring to the stage. And we, our mask, our armor, what have you, that we wear to present to the public. And for that hour show or 2 hour show, we give you all a little vacation from reality and we bring you into our little fantasy world, our dreamland. And once again, we can escape into the wonderful world of humor and music where things can't hurt us. Maybe it's our never, never land or what have you. And, you know, it's our wonderful world of Disney, you know, it's escapism for me.
Hmm. Michael, what impact has KV had in Milwaukee's LGBTQ scene?
So Karen is really quite a force of nature. So while many think of, you know, drag queens as simply entertainers, she has an excellent point. Drag has long been a form of defiance, of resistance, and most importantly, of community mobilization. Going back to the earliest days of underground gay bars, they were a place where, you know, there weren't a lot of people who wanted to be seen. So imagine trying to be a fundraiser in a space where most of your beneficiaries can't be publicly known. And Karen has really taken that to the next level beyond simply being a hostess, an MC, a fundraiser. Karen actually has launched her own charity. She has her own foundation, which gives Milwaukee's youth access and experiences in the performing arts.
with this cultural appreciation for the arts, KV, I'm wondering, is that in a way how the drag scene has evolved? How has it changed in Milwaukee?
Well, it's grown up. It's become a cottage industry. I credit RuPaul. I credit the popularity of it. Right now, you can't go to a car wash without seeing a drag queen. All of a sudden, every restaurant and bar and any business, it seems like they use the wonderful world of drag as a hook. And I think it's marvelous that what once was kind of scoffed at and thought of as a bastardized form of show business has finally gotten its own just dues and desserts, if you will. I still find it very hard. I don't have a manager or an agent. I'm kind of a one-trick pony. And when people engage me, so many times, I don't even know what to ask for because I'll say, well, what do you need? What do you want? And it's like, I'm still that 12-year-old in the corner with knock knees going, oh my God, I got invited to the party. I'm thrilled and excited that I'm desirable or I rank up with the likes of my peers that I'm wanted. And so that's still so very important to me. And I'm kind of at the, I guess you could say, the twilight of my life and career. And I do every once in a while get somebody saying, when are you hanging up the lashes and the Ferragamos? And I said, I don't know. I don't know. I guess when they stop asking and they stop inviting and they stop wanting me to appear. And I'm very flattered that I'm still included in the run. And I think it goes back to Harry Hansen's book about 5 years ago, maybe. He did The Legends of Drag, and I was included with a handful of other wonderful entertainers from the Milwaukee area, as well as throughout the United States. And it kind of provided a renaissance. It's like, oh, yeah, KV's been around forever.
Yeah, and there's not just this generation gap in terms of knowledge transfer, in terms of stories being told, in terms of heritage connection. There's also a generational ageism in the LGBTQ community, and that has long been there. And, people like Karen at one time would have been ushered right off the stage for being too old.
Right.
That ageism is a powerful dividing line because it tells our elders that there's no more space for them, that they no longer have purpose or value, or they're no longer welcome. And one of the things we've been trying to do with the Beacons Project is assert that not only did these elders blaze the trail and carve out these spaces, they own them. I mean, these are a place that they're always going to be welcome because they built them.
Well, Michael and KV, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I could go on and on for hours and hours. There's so much more to share with you. But thank you for your interest in the invitation.
Yeah, thank you so much. It really means a lot for us to be able to share the story of the Beacons with the state. And we do invite everyone to visit us at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee on June 16th when we debut the Beacons of Bruce City documentary featuring 8 local elders who have changed history.
And that is Michael Takash, president of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, and Karen Valentine, or KV, a Milwaukee-based drag performer, social columnist, and philanthropist. And we talked about this new documentary, Beacons of Brew City, that is debuting June 16th.
Earlier in the show, we talked about Wisconsin communities that have canceled their contracts with the company Flock for their cameras that gather data about cars for law enforcement.
And we want to hear from you on this. Has this been a contentious issue in your community? Have these cameras been put into place? Has there been pushback or even a cancellation of a contract?
And more generally, whether it's license plate reading cameras or facial recognition technology, where do you draw the line when it comes to public safety and surveillance and privacy?
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Beatrice Lawrence, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Brad Kohlberg.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.